there, everybody. You are listening to This Show Is So Gay. I'm your host, Ken Schnack. This is episode number 397. As always, you can get in touch with us by dropping us a line, pen and email, send it on over to ken@thisshowissogay.com. Stroll on over to thisshowissogay.com to learn all about the fun things happening with our little gay radio show that could. You can follow us on Twitter. The handle is thisshowissogay. And of course, go on over to that Facebook. Type in This Show Is So Gay. Like us, because we sure as heck like you. Another incredible episode for you this week. Let's get started. Let me introduce someone to you all. Dr. Robin Henderson Espinoza is a writer, a theologian, an activist, and so much more. Now, normally, over the past 8+ years of doing this show, I write my own bios, but I have to lift this next sentence straight from Robin's Huffington Post page because it's that brilliant, and I quote, "As an anti-oppression, anti-racist, non-binary, transgressive Latinx, Robin takes seriously their call as an activist, theologian, and ethicist to bridge together theories and practices that result in communities responding to pressing social concerns." Holy cow, we're going to talk about all that. Robin has been public theologian in residence at Faith Matters Network in Nashville, Tennessee, and visiting assistant professor of ethics at the Pacific School of Religion, graduate Theological Union, but right this second, they are here with us. Robin, welcome to This Show Is So Gay.
Hey, thanks so much.
We have so much ground to cover just with that one sentence. Are you ready?
I'm ready. Let's go.
When little Robin was running around, was the dream to become a theologian?
No. I mean, is that okay to say on the radio? I don't know. I say that word a lot.
It's all good. We'll bleep out every instance and love every second of it.
Okay. No, it wasn't ever my dream to become a theologian, but I will say that being in Catholic school for many, many years and being the only one in their class to not make a first communion in the first grade really set the tone for a life journey of asking the tough questions.
Yeah. What was that big moment where you said, okay, I'm asking tough questions, I actually need to make this my career?
So I remember let me just say I have 3 degrees in theology.
Love it.
which is crazy on some level. I'm not trying to be disparaging and using that language. You just don't think about someone deciding straight out of high school to earn a degree in theology.
Right.
Unless maybe they're going to serve the church or something. And, you know, I never was interested in serving the church. I had interest in asking the hard questions about the church. And it wasn't until I was in my PhD program where I had now, you know, my undergrad is in theology from a Baptist university in Texas, where I had great professors. I was the only queer person, the only person of color in my classes, the only person with a vagina, for example, female assigned at birth in my classes. So I was in classes with a lot of straight white dudes. And I remember those early years when I was in my undergrad, right, in my late teens and my early 20s, when I was just like asking a ton of questions.
Yeah.
And because I was interested in a larger conversation than just what is right and what is wrong. So I think that as I, you know, finished my undergrad theology, I moved to the big city of Chicago to do a master's degree in theological ethics with a Latin American Baptist theologian, Nancy Bedford. And she, you know, she really is the person who has shaped my understanding of being a theologian, my imagination, if you will, of being a theologian and ethicist, that it always has to start from the place of story of one's own self. So I'm going to answer your question, but I feel like I need to preface my answer with this piece about Nancy's professorship of me that, you know, what Nancy said to me, because I was a really braggadocious Texan. You know, I moved from Texas to Chicago, didn't have a coat, wore t-shirts and jeans all the time, showed up to class in a University of Texas t-shirt and a pair of jeans. And, you know, at some point Nancy said, you really should do something where you could wear your t-shirt and jeans. I don't think being a professor is the thing that you should do, you know. Of course, now I'm sort of known for my queer fashion, my dapper queer fashion of like bow ties and dress shirts and whatnot. But Nancy and I had a lot of conversations over the 3 years that I was a student with her. And what Nancy said to me at one point was, look, you're brilliant. You have these moments of deep brilliance. You need to be faithful in the small things. And it was not until I was in my PhD many years later that I began to understand that, like, my call in life, my vocation in life, the place that deeply resonates with my own self and the cries of the world are those places, the in-between places, the tense places of asking the tough questions. And it was when I was in Minneapolis at the Creating Change Conference in 2011, where my academic partner and I, Dr. Nikki Young, who is a Black queer ethicist, we had been flown there by the Human Rights Campaign to talk about being queer religious scholars. And our mentor, Dr. Sharon Groves, began to ask some hard questions, right? In a room of about 500 people, you know, all the, you know, I don't know if you're familiar with Creating Change, but
oh, yeah.
It's a place where, like, you know, movement work, largely secular movement work, right? The queer arm of justice where they show up. And we were in a session that was largely pushed out by for people of faith. And Nikki and I are both trained as these queer religious scholars, and we have a sort of a unique approach to religion, both from our particular racialized standpoints. So it was a room of about 500 people, both secular people and people of faith and everyone in between. And there is where I began to just tell my story of struggle and began to really live the questions I had been asking. And so it was really in 2011 where I was like, okay, this is what my job is right now.
It's amazing. You know, I think in almost 400 episodes, I don't know that we've ever had an ethicist on, and I'm not sure that our listening audience even knows necessarily what that means. I'm not even sure I always know what that means, and I'm a college professor who teaches about ethics and leadership. What does ethics mean to you? How does this play into your life?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think about ethics from a queer lens. And what I mean by that is I don't ascribe to a normative understanding of ethics. And oftentimes we understand ethics as what ought we do, right? That's the normative expression of ethics. So let me give you an example. We ought not to kill people.
Okay.
That would be a normative ethical statement. I happen to agree with that we ought not to be killing, right? So we can talk about that from the place of war and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And what I try to do is I try to talk about social practices from the place of value, separate from norms. And a lot of the work that I do stems from what I like to call the politics of radical difference, which I glean from continental philosophy, in particular, Gilles Deleuze and Felix Guattari.
Oh, yeah.
And so how I understand ethics are a set of social practices that hopefully are grounded in from the place of value that are informed by our relationships. So I start from the place of value and our practices, our habits, versus principles or norms. I mean, I think we all probably have principles and norms. So I'm less interested in what is right or wrong and actually what is the impact of our social practices.
I think that impact of social practices is a great place to pick up this thread, because I think that some people might think, all right, well, that Dr. Robin Henderson Espinoza, they live in their head and it's there's no practical application here. But indeed, this really is what we're doing on a daily basis in both our specific community and the community at large.
Yeah. I mean, we all have social practices, all of us. right? I mean, some of our social practices are meeting in coffee shops. Well, what coffee shops are we meeting in?
Right.
Are we meeting at Starbucks? Are we meeting at the corporatized entity of coffee where maybe there's not a fair wage for people, a fair and just wage for people? Where are our communities gathering? How are the servers treated, right? And when I say social practices, it's not just one social practices, but social practices are connected to other social practices that are connected to other social practices. There is a deep entanglement of practices that all have impact.
Yeah. You know, I was reading that sentence in your bio, and the phrase pressing social concerns is one of the many pieces of that sentence that jumps out at me. And my concern for you, because I do have concerns for you because your lens is so rich and you have so much to offer, my concern is that how do you go about defining which pressing social concerns you focus your attention on? Because I think that you could just focus on everything, but there's that thing called burnout, and I worry about that.
Yeah. So I take a siesta every day. Every day I take a siesta, even when I'm traveling. And I'm surrounded by a group of people of color largely and a handful of white folks who really just love me and help me relax and walk with me. You know, there's a practice of accompaniment with my people. So I think I'm far less concerned about burnout. I'm far more concerned about how much work there is to do in this world and in the LGBTQ community, et cetera.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about some of that specific work. I have been reading your writing for quite some time now, and I enjoy your writing on the Huffington Post, and we will certainly link to that for everybody here. And some pieces recently that most definitely got me thinking and piqued my interest and all that fun stuff. So let's start off. Let's talk a little bit about HB 142. And you wrote about HB 142 and you said this, quote, "This is an act of violence on my body, my people, and many of yours." Tell our listeners about HB 142 and why we should all be doing something.
Yeah, so HB 142 was the supposed repeal of HB2, and you know, I really think that it is an anti-repeal, because what happened was it removed all of the protections for LGBTQ plus people in North Carolina. So HB 142 is really now the failed attempt of what the governor of North Carolina, I mean, he ran on a platform of repealing HB2. And you know, so let me just say this also, like, I don't live in North Carolina, but I have dear loved ones who live in North Carolina. I have movement partners who live in North Carolina. So when I talk about my people, I'm talking about those people who, not just those people, but my people who are on the front lines in North Carolina, fighting at every turn. And so I just want to raise up folks like Michael Slack, Bishop Tanya Rawls, Reverend Dr. William J. Barber II, Reverend Alba Onofrio, and so many others who are tirelessly working to eradicate the justice against transgender nonconforming and otherwise other queer folks. So really, HB 142 is drastic failure for our community. And here's what's scary. Other states could do the same thing.
Yeah.
Because we always talk about we live in a democracy, but the reality is we live in a republic where states are a real thing in our country. And so we need to think seriously of the impact of HB 142 on other right and right-leaning states who don't want to deal with what I call the politics of radical difference that is our human flourishing, with particular attention to queer people. So that's HB 142. It's real scary. I don't like it. It's where we are right now, and we need to mobilize folks to begin telling the truth about our transgender folks in our community, and And we need to pay careful attention to the ways in which our ethics, right, our norms, how the norms are informing our social practices. I think that's the wrong way to do ethics.
All right, listeners, again, and I'll tell you why I'm sighing in a second. We're here with Dr. Robin Henderson Espinoza, writer, theologian, activist, so much more. I'm sighing because I almost don't want to move on to other issues because there's so much to address with just that. But as you said earlier, that's not the only thing going on in the world.
Yeah, that isn't the only thing going on in the world. And, you know, can I work at the intersection of race, class, gender, sexuality, the multiple, you know, what I like to call multi-system oppressions? So the other thing that's going on in this world is we are living in a time of lynching.
Yeah.
I'll say that again. We are living in a time of lynching. And that is not good. That is not good for any of us. It is certainly not good for darker skinned folks, in particular Black and brown folks. And we have to figure out, how to be human with one another. I said sometime last year at a conference in D.C., I said, we are deeply failing to be human with one another. And if we don't figure out how to be human with one another, we will not survive ourselves. And I still mean that. I still really believe that we are failing to be human with one another.
Yeah.
So race is a real issue in this country. It always has been. Class disparity, poverty in this country is a real thing. The rich continue to get richer. The poor continue to get poorer. We have to figure out a way to either share the wealth, which no one wants to do because people are real committed to serving the almighty U.S. dollar. But we have to figure out a way to either share the wealth or create access for all persons to be able to put money in their pocket.
Right.
We have to.
You know, you say the country, and holy cow, do I agree, but can we narrow the focus even more? You know, there are any number of people who are like, well, at least we have these things figured out in the LGBTQ community, but we don't. We have these issues of race, and we have these issues of class, and we have these issues of not being human to each other, even within our own community.
Yeah, I mean, so I'm going to say this, and your listeners may not like this.
It's okay.
But I'm going to say it because for Christians, it's Lent. And, you know, I tend to like some of the religious practices that our world religions offer. I mean, I didn't give up anything for Lent. Let me just be real with you. But in Lent, I'm trying to tell one truth a day. Right? So here's my Lenten truth. My Lenten truth is, let's be real about the LGBT community.
Yeah.
The LGBT community in this country is dominated by cis white folks.
Yeah.
And it is funded largely by cis gay men. And that has created such a disparity for women of color, for some lesbians, trans folks, and we don't really know what to do with bisexual folks.
Right.
So we don't have it figured out in our community. And if we did, we have to be able to tackle it from a multi-pronged approach because, as Audre Lorde teaches us, life is not a single issue adventure.
You know, I'll speak from the eye because I think it's important that we speak from the eye, but I will say that I do know that you and I are pretty much exactly the same age, and I am also feeling pretty confident that you have been having some of the same conversations for so long as well. Like, I hear what you're saying, and I have that reaction of, okay, but we need to be doing better in the LGBTQ community. And at this point, why is that not happening? I have no tolerance for that anymore. And so I'm curious if you occasionally reach that point of, oh, we're kind of saying the same thing over and over again for years and years. Where is the change?
Yeah, I mean, I think that I do have a lot of the same conversations. But I don't find, at least not yet, I don't find myself frustrated.
Good.
With the conversations so much as I find myself continuing to push people into sort of new areas of their imagination. And I think that's what keeps it fresh for me, because, I mean, I do spend a lot of my time with academics. I mean, the closest people to me are academics and movement people. And, you know, movement people and academics don't always get along. I have found a way to stand in between in a hybrid space. And I think that while the conversations I have are repetitive, they aren't stifling, because questions keep bubbling up to the surface, either from me or from other people. So if anything is happening, I'm helping people discover a way to ask new questions. And yeah. So that's what keeps it fresh for me.
Nice. Maybe that was my Lenten truth, that I'm getting a little bit frustrated. And there is a little bit of hilarity to the fact that I'm sharing a Lenten truth, because I'm a gay Jew from New Jersey. So, you know, there's that.
Yes.
Just putting that out
you
there.
You Jews, though, you Jews have great rituals. I'm just saying.
We do. You know, and that's come up a lot on this show before, of that bond that is through ritual, if not necessarily through the observance of faith. So yes, I'm a fan. I have to read a sentence for our listening audience. This is from a piece you wrote called "We Need to Address Femphobia in the Queer Community." You wrote this. I hope. Can understand how brilliant sentences like this are. "Part of this dialectic is a notion of vulnerability. When masculinity is able to embrace the vulnerability in the radical act of recognizing femmes, then we begin to shift our politics and practices that not only disrupt the logic of dominance, but destabilize practices of femphobia that contribute to femme erasure." Hey, students of mine, that's how you write sentences that create change. That's good stuff, Robin.
Thanks, Ken. Thanks. Yeah, so I wrote that. I've been a fan of Dapper Q since it came out. I've been featured as one of the 100 top Dapper Qs. And I really support Dapper Q. You know, Dapper Q is owned and run by a woman of color. I don't know if people know that. And when they came out with the High Femme campaign, there was a lot of pushback and a lot of comments that I read from people saying, I thought this was for Dapper. I thought this was for, you know, MOC, masculine of center folk. I didn't think this was a place for femmes. And so I reached out to my buddy Sonny Oram up in Boston at Queer Fashion, where I've also been featured. And I'm like, look, let's figure out a way to address this problem of femphobia. So, you know, Sonny and I talked, and we have something coming out to talk about femmes and the need for femmes. And so then I reached out to Anita over at Dapper Q, and I said, look, Anita, I love Dapper Q. I support Dapper Q. The High Femme campaign is so, so important. But I want to make an intervention that doesn't rest on masculinity affirming femmes, because I think that is where we've gotten into trouble. What we've created is we create a framework of deep, deep misogyny in all of our communities, and we've created a dynamic that femmes are only affirmed from male-bodied persons or masculine-identified or masculine-of-center-identified people. That is a problem of misogyny and patriarchy. So I wrote that article in favor of the High Femme campaign and their real need to address the underlying misogynistic, heteropatriarchal bullshit that frames so many of our communities. So That's where that came from. There's going to be some other stuff come out, Dapper Q and Queer Fashion, on celebrating femmes. And yeah, I'm excited to be a part of that work.
Such good stuff. When you wake up in the morning, how do you decide this is what I'm going to focus on for the day?
Well, let me just say this, that almost every morning that I'm home, I live with two Puerto Ricans who are both Vanderbilt students. One is a PhD student in homiletics, and One is getting their Master Divinity degree from Vanderbilt Divinity. And so every morning that I'm home, I say, RJ, let's have coffee. And so it's like 30 minutes of peace for me, Ken.
Wow.
It's like my favorite time of the day. I mean, except my siesta. My siesta is also my favorite time of the day. So in the morning, you know, I mean, I wake up, like this morning I woke up, had 43 unread emails.
Oh, wow.
And I was like, what do people need? You know, like, why are you emailing me? I was feeling a little oppressed by email. So RJ texted and they said, coffee, ? And I said, yes, I had already put it on and started making it. I was like, yes, we were texting. And we live in the same house and we were texting. So I said, yes, I was just about to text you to let you know I put it on. So we sat down and we had this like beautiful time of conversation and reconnecting. I've been gone for about 5 days. And I decided this morning that today, so I'm grounded for 10 days in Nashville, and then I'll hit the road again. And so today what I'm focusing on is just listening. That's my focus today. So I'm doing a lot of talking right now, but today I'm just listening to folks. So I had lunch with my kinfolk over at Faith Matters Network, Reverend Jennifer Bailey and the lovely Mickey Scott Bay Jones. We had lunch and I just sat there and listened to stories. So that's what I do. I use my coffee hour with RJ as a moment to really set the pace and the tone of my day. And today it's one of listening.
Why aren't we all better at the listening?
Because we suck as humans.
That can't be the tagline for this week's episode.
Yeah, I don't know.
Okay.
I don't know. I mean, part of the reason why we suck at listening is because we don't know our own story.
Yeah.
We don't know how to listen to our own story. And if we don't know how to listen to our own story, then we certainly can't listen to the stories of others.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, what is coming up for you that you are excited about?
Oh, I'm excited about these 10 days being home. I am excited about that. I have a lot of writing to do. I'm real excited to teach at Vanderbilt this week. My dear, dear colleague and mentor and friend, Dr. Ellen Armour, has invited me to come and be a guest scholar in her queer theory class and her queer theology class. And so they're reading a piece of mine that I wrote on power and sex, power, deviance and sex. And so I'm super excited about Tuesday and Thursday. It's going to be a great time with Ellen and being in class with her and with the students there. So I'm super stoked about that. And I'm just really excited to just breathe for a little bit and get connected with folks back here at home. I hang out with these three straight women who are older than I am by several years. And, you know, these women just keep it real, you know? So I'm really excited to get together with them. And then, you know, I'm going to hang out with the American Philosophical Association next week in Seattle. So I'm excited about that because I've never been in that academic space. And I'm also like, what the hell am I doing with these people? So.
Oh, you're making change. You're making change. Let me ask you one last question. So, because I think the Vanderbilt week is a great example. So you're going to spend this time in this academic setting. You're going to be in front of students. There's going to be so many questions. There's going to be so many dialogues. How do you go about measuring, right? We love our little metrics, what it is that you're trying to accomplish.
Well, I mean, I have one clear goal in life, and that is bridging with difference. And what I don't mean is that we all have to agree. But if we don't figure out how to learn to bridge with one another, that is also going to be a failure of humanity. So I will measure my, I don't want to say success because that's such neoliberal capitalist language, but I will measure my impact and my effectiveness on whether or not I was able to bridge with these folks. Now, some of them, some of them know me and know my work. I don't know them, largely because I'm a fairly public scholar and people have read my stuff for several years. So they will be familiar with me. And so I will measure my effectiveness for change on whether or not I've been able to bridge with who, for me, are strangers.
I think you're doing that right now. I think you do that every day. Listeners, this is what we need you to do. Stroll on over to irobyn.com. That's irobyn.com. And you can learn more about Robyn Henderson Espinoza. You can follow Robyn on Twitter, which I highly encourage you to do. That handle is irobyn. And Robyn's writing is on the Huffington Post, and it's going to make you think, and you might have to look up some words, and that's okay, because we should look up words that we don't know, because they can deepen our understanding of these issues that are actually happening in the world. I have to tell you, Robyn, I am so incredibly inspired by you. You really are bridging that theory and practice in a way that, as an academic myself, I am always striving to do. I think that this work can't just live in an academic setting and not in the world at large. And there's real change that needs to be created. And you are certainly starting that dialogue and continuing to do so. So I appreciate so much the energy you put out there into the world.
Yeah, thanks, Ken. And, you know, like, let's keep talking, because I can't do this in a vacuum, you know? So I'm about building relationships with radically different people and, like, having the hard conversations. And so I'm all about being in conversation so that we can create radical social change.
Let's be clear. This is segment number 1 of 8 with Dr. Robyn Henderson Espinoza. Robyn, please keep doing what you're doing.
Thanks, Ken.
All of these lines across my face tell you the story of who I am. So many stories of where I've been, and now I got to where I am. But these stories don't mean anything when you've got no one to tell them to. It's true, I was made for you. I climbed across the mountain tops.
All right, folks, and we are back, and we get to talk about another incredible organization doing incredible work. This time around, we're talking about Horizons Foundation. Horizons Foundation is a community foundation rooted in and dedicated to the LGBTQ community. They exist to, among many things, mobilize and increase resources for the LGBTQ movement and organizations that secure the rights, meet the needs, and celebrate the lives of LGBTQ people. Here to talk all about Horizons Foundation is their president, Roger Dowdy. Roger has been an activist and leader in the LGBT movement for more than 25 years, and he has led Horizons Foundation since 2002. Prior to joining the foundation, he served as the executive director of Horizons Community Services in Chicago, which is the Midwest's largest LGBT social service and advocacy organization. He's done so much other work. Before Chicago, he was the director of programs for the Los Angeles LGBT Center. He has also served as the president of the Gay and Lesbian Activists Alliance in Washington, D.C. So many other credits, but if I list them all, we won't have time to actually chat. So I will just say, Roger, welcome to This Show Is So Gay.
Well, thank you so much, Ken, and you're way too kind. You could probably reach the conclusion of that list in no time.
That's actually not true, because what a list, Roger. I mean, we have to start with you before we talk about Horizons Foundation. How would you trace for our listeners your journey to advocacy? What was that pivotal moment for you when you decided this is clearly what I should be doing?
That moment came when I was living in Washington, D.C. in the later 80s, and on moving to Washington in 1987, which happened to be the week of the October March on Washington, which I considered to be a tremendous welcoming party for me.
Yes.
To living in D.C. And I quickly became involved with the local community there in Washington, starting out with anti-violence-related work, police trainings, and the things that anti-violence projects do across the country. And then I became involved with the organization, the Gay and Lesbian Activists Alliance, which has a storied and long history dating back to the early 1970s and some of the earliest days of the movement and the organized movement. In fact, one of GLA's founders was Dr. Frank Kameny,
yes.
who passed away recently
yeah.
and was one of the true heroes of our movement. So I felt very, very fortunate indeed to be in that position. And it was the late 80s, as I said, and so it was the time when not only was the epidemic at its very worst and was every day in the news and, more importantly, in the lives of the people of D.C. and across the country, it was also a time when Congress, which has oversight under the Constitution over the District of Columbia, was laying a heavy hand on district affairs, including those around LGBT rights, led by none other than our one-time nemesis, Senator Jesse Helms.
Yeah.
And the combination of those led me not only into the work, but also it just became my passion. And I don't think that there's a way that you can explain exactly why or how something takes your heart. And takes your soul, but it did. And although I've worked in some other areas since then, most of my life has been involved in working in the movement, and I consider it a tremendous privilege to have been able to do this work and to continue to today.
You have that privilege to have done this work in so many different geographic locales, you know, D.C. and L.A. and Chicago. Are there regional differences in doing this work and in the way that you approach it?
Every community is different, of course. There are different organizations. There are different histories of the community and the way that organizations come to be. So, for example, in Los Angeles, the Los Angeles Center very early on became a very significant organization and grew tremendously. Los Angeles has lots and lots of other very important LGBTQ organizations, so the LA Center continued to play a very, very large and central role. Other communities, for example, are a little more diffuse. They most likely have a community center. Often the community center provides a very, very important core of services and programs and advocacy, and there may be a lot more organizations. So it depends a great deal on what the organizational histories are. But I would say, honestly, Ken, that there's more that's similar than there is different, because in all of the places over the years that I've been involved in the movement, people are working towards our basic rights, towards having respect from local authorities, toward making sure that people who have needs in our community, whether that's HIV or breast cancer or other health needs or youth services, elders needing services, that those needs are met. And on a local level, whether it's Chicago or LA or DC or here in the Bay Area, that is often what moves people, our national fight for our rights and what is happening to our friends, our brothers and sisters and neighbors in the communities around us.
Yeah, so important. You know, you've been involved with so many different organizations. What's Roger's step one to getting to know a new community, a new organization? What's your approach in introducing yourself in that way?
The single most important thing and what I tried to do here was to meet with as many local leaders as I was able to identify.
Yeah.
Being at a place like Horizons Foundation, as a community foundation, we have connections to literally hundreds of organizations in the Bay Area and nationwide. And so it is a process of meeting with the people who lead those organizations, or may not necessarily be the executive director in every case, but people who bring a perspective on a particular part of the community, part of the community's history, some of the issues that are facing us. And they're the source of information. And a place like Horizons Foundation, as a community foundation, we operate in partnership with the organizations that we exist to support and to serve. So that's the single best source of support. And then, of course, there are people who are in the donor community and city officials and others who also can provide perspective. So it's a great deal of listening.
Yeah.
It's the first and most important thing.
Well, I am so excited to talk about Horizons Foundation. I don't know if you know this, Roger. It is not a new organization.
I do know that Horizons is not a new organization. In fact, we were founded 37 years ago at this point. We were founded in 1980. Wow. And it was actually interesting. It was founded as the charitable arm of the Golden Gate Business Association. And for anybody who's read up on the history of the Bay Area in the time of Harvey Milk and all of the years around that, the Golden Gate Business Association actually played a very important role as a gathering place and also a voice for the city's growing LGBT business community. And in 1980, a handful of people with that organization decided that the business community, which had been involved in political things for quite a while, needed to have something more substantive and a more ongoing statement about its commitment to the community. And they founded the Golden Gate Business Association Foundation. About 5 years, 6 years after that, Horizons Foundation became independent of Golden Gate Business Association and has been working in the community ever since.
For our listeners who hear this phrase community foundation and they're not exactly clear what that means, how would you go about framing that?
It's a great question. A community foundation is a foundation which in its very simplest form is an entity that typically, not always, but typically gives out grants to support organizations, nonprofits in the community. And a community foundation is supported by people in the community itself, so by a donor base. Over time, as community foundations grow, if they are, assuming they are successful, they begin to develop a portfolio of assets, including possibly an endowment, which then begins to support their work in making grants to the community on a long-term basis. But by contrast, what many people think of when they think of a foundation is a private foundation. And that means an entity that was founded with a very generous gift from somebody, often in estate, although it could be during someone's lifetime. And it is out of those assets that individual or family gave that the grants are made. Community foundations are based entirely in the community, both in the grants that we make as well as in the support that we receive.
Got it. Now, a big piece of this whole puzzle, which I'm so excited to talk about, is Give Out Day. I can't imagine any of our listeners have never heard of Give Out Day, but just in the off chance that someone has stumbled upon our little gay radio show and doesn't know about Give Out Day, tell our listeners all about that.
Well, Give Out Day is this wonderful invention that started 5 years ago, and it did not start at Horizons Foundation, but we became its home last year, and will continue to be its national home. And the idea of Give Out Day is that our organizations, the not-for-profit organizations that advocate for our rights and then meet our community's needs, and as you said earlier, that celebrate our lives through theater and other forms of the arts, that they need resources to do their work. They never have enough resources to do all the work that they need to do. And Give Out Day is a way of enabling organizations, empowering them to raise money for themselves. Most of our organizations are not very large.
Right.
They don't have big development departments. They can't mount big fundraising campaigns. They're smaller. They're medium-sized, and they're doing some of the most vital work. And what Give Out Day does is it gives them this national electronic platform to be able to raise money, reach new donors, reach their existing donors, and on one single day to say, let's all come together, all of us as LGBTQ people and our allies, and give to support the organizations that do so much in our community every single day.
Oh, man, this is important stuff, Roger. Again, listeners, we are here with Roger Dowdy, the president of the Horizons Foundation. Now, let's be a little bit critical for a second. Give Out Day is coming up. It's on April 20th, and everybody's going to get a ton of emails from a lot of different organizations asking us to support them. And I suspect that you all at Horizons Foundation are in a little bit of an eagle-eye position that maybe some of the rest of us are not in and can maybe see, you know, one of our biggest fears, Roger, is that maybe there's some organizations that are working cross purposes or that duplicate efforts. How do we, as individuals who are going to get a slew of emails and want to support each and every one of them, how do we go about deciding, you know, who do we support?
That's a great question, Ken. The very first thing that I say to anybody who asks a question about, well, what should I support? There's so many organizations out there, is first of all, follow your heart.
Yeah.
give where your heart tells you to give. Give where your passion lies, whether that's with LGBT youth services or elder services or litigation and advocacy for our rights. You know, different people are called more to do different things. That's the first part. The second part has to do more with your head, because we shouldn't lose our heads and just blindly follow what our emotions tell us to do. And our head entails looking at, well, what is the organization doing? Is there any indication that it's getting results? Does it have a track record? Has it been around for a while? Does the organization's leadership have a good reputation? Have they been around for a while? Which is often a good sign of organizational stability, not always, but very often. And there are also resources online that donors can go to in this, our modern age, to find out more information about organizations before they make a decision to support them. So first, go with your heart. And secondly, get your head into the picture as well. But the most important thing is, please do not let your concerns about duplications of services get in the way of supporting the organization that you choose. The chances that you are supporting things that are unnecessarily duplicative is far, far, far less than the chance that you are supporting something that is going to touch or even save somebody's life once that money goes to work.
So important to hear that. Thank you for that. You know, I was reading about the values of Horizon Foundation online, and my eye is going to always hone in on that word diversity. Talk to our listeners about how diversity, you all write on the site, we take pride in the histories, cultures, and achievements of LGBTQ people in the San Francisco Bay Area and across the nation and the world. Talk to our listeners about how being inclusive, how diversity plays out in the work that you all do.
Thank you. That could not be a more timely and important question. But diversity, and as we often call it, inclusion, which is a more affirmative way of framing a similar idea, of making sure that we are all included and that, as is sometimes said, that no one is left behind, and making that not just a slogan but a reality. What it means in Horizon's work is that those who run the organization, and that means my board of directors as well as the staff, are reasonably reflective of the tremendous diversity of people who make up our community. And secondly, that it's expressed in the work that we do. Where do our grants go? Who gets our grants? What kind of support are we able to offer to organizations that, or individual social entrepreneurs, individual activists who are looking for support for some great idea, but they may or may not have the benefit of having written grants before.
Right.
So how do we, Horizons, make sure that we provide those individuals, especially from communities that have been historically and currently underrepresented and under-resourced, have what they need to be able to compete equally and get the resources that they need to carry out the work in communities that, again, have too often been overlooked? And we take that very seriously, and so we provide, just for example, in developing applications for our annual community grants process, our grants team spends significant amounts of time working directly with people on helping them craft their applications, especially those who haven't had that experience before.
Yeah. Can we just pause here? Because that has come up over and over on this show over the past 9 years, that there are incredible community leaders out there who are impassioned speakers who can sway a congressman if only they had 2 minutes with them, who might not have the most developed skill set in writing grants, in getting money together. And those, that's indeed an important skill set that people need to have in order to do this work, is it not?
It absolutely is. If you're going to be looking for support from foundations or from corporate partners or certainly government agencies, then you have got to have a certain amount of skill in writing grants. And I want to demythologize the writing of grants a little bit too, because essentially a good grant is about telling a good story. You've got to back it up with some financial information and other things like that, but that's where a place like Horizons can provide a great deal of help to help organizations negotiate and navigate those kinds of requirements. But basically, you're telling a story. And the story is all about, why are you, whoever you are writing the grant, why are you passionate about what it is that you're doing, and what is the community that you're going to serve, and what are you going to do for them, and what's going to be the result of that? And that's a story.
Yeah.
And that is always going to move people, whether they're foundation officers or they're individual donors or that congressperson that you mentioned. It's going to be the stories. And every activist that I know is able to tell a story.
Yeah. We never have someone like you on our show, Roger, without giving you the floor to extol the virtues for our listening audience of your staff, of your board, your advisors, your volunteers. I give you the floor to do so.
Well, thank you for that opportunity. Going back to something that I spoke about earlier in the show, I feel enormously privileged, and a great deal of that privilege comes from just being able to work in this movement. But the privilege is also working with the tremendous people that I get to work with. My colleagues on staff, we are a sizable organization. We make about $2.5 million in grants every year. Our staff is only 10 people, so we have a lean staff. So every one of those colleagues makes a big difference. My board of directors, who are all volunteers, are equally critical. And we work with lots of people in the community who help us in reviewing many of our grant applications and are the ones who actually do the work. We're here to support the work and encourage people and provide them with some tools and some resources. And Give Out Day is a way of helping organizations to help themselves to raise the resources they need. It's not just sending out checks. It's helping organizations with tools and training and an opportunity. They've got to take that opportunity. And being able to work with people who are so on fire about what they do and what they care about and what changes need to happen makes coming in every day really an easy and wonderful thing to do.
I think you just answered my last question for you, but I'm going to ask it nonetheless. Okay. You know, you have the motto there of Horizons Foundation, fueling the LGBT movement. How does this work fuel you, Roger?
It fuels me two ways. The first is, as you suggested, it's the people.
Yeah.
The people that I get to work with and the people that I get to see. And the second is that all of us who are involved in this movement, and that means everybody from, you know, those of us who happen to have a job in the movement to people who write a check or people who volunteer, everyone who does anything for this community, we have this opportunity to be part of a profoundly historic time in not just LGBTQ history, but American history. And not just American history, but world history. Because nobody has done before what LGBTQ people have been doing and are doing in this country and around the world as well, to speak with our own voices, to advocate for ourselves, and to move slowly but very certainly toward the world in which we have the same equality and dignity and justice that everybody else deserves as well. And that is something that only very lucky people get to be part of.
Yeah. Oh, and we love hearing about it. Listeners, this is what we need you to do. Stroll on over to horizonsfoundation.org. That's horizonsfoundation.org. And you can learn all about Horizons Foundation. I guarantee, listeners, after you tour around their site, you will be fueled, because this is such important work. I just keep saying that word over and over, because it's not just about money. It's about how we tell our stories and how we build support and how we build awareness. And as you all shout out as well, it's how we build community and compassion. And it's a beautiful thing to read about. You guys are doing such incredible work, Roger.
Well, thank you so much, Ken, for the opportunity to be on the program and all of your kind words. And thank you to all of your listeners for tuning in and for becoming part of Give Out Day on April 20th.
There it is. Give Out Day, listeners, April 20th. Keep your eyes open. Listen to the stories. Share them. It's not just about donating, though you can do that as well, but also share these stories with other people, because that is certainly going to help all of us move forward together. Roger, to you and your board and your staff and your volunteers, please keep doing what you're doing.
Thank you so much, Ken. And just for your listeners' convenience, they can find out all about Give Out Day at giveoutday.org.
There it is, giveoutday.org, everybody. Thank you, Roger.
Thank you so much, Ken. Take care.
Well, I've heard that there's a secret chord the day they played and it pleased the Lord. But you don't really care for music, do ya? It goes like this, a fourth, a fifth, a minor fall, and the major lives, and the baffled king composing hallelujah, 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 hallelujah. Well, your faith was strong, but you needed proof. You saw her bathing on the roof. Her beauty and the moonlight overthrew you. She tied you to her kitchen chair. She broke you the rope and she cut your hair. And from your lips she drew a hallelujah. Hallelujah.
All right, folks, and we are back. Well, we basically have no time left on this week's episode. We normally do so many different news stories, but we don't have time for news stories. I will just throw the scariest one out at you. And I know this was such an inspiring episode this week, and I don't want to end on a sad note, but we have to report on things like this. And this story comes to you from Pink News, and it's being widely reported all over the place. Gay men arrested in a purge in the Russian region of Chechnya are being held in concentration camp-style prisons. A lot of reports are alleging this. Early reports emerged this month that gay people are being targeted in the region, which is part of Russia but has substantial autonomy. Russian newspapers and human rights groups report that more than 100 gay men have been detained in connection with their non-traditional sexual orientation or suspicion of such as part of a purge. Several people were also repeatedly feared dead following violent raids. And then there's this chilling response. This is from a Chechenian government spokesperson who denied that there are any gay people to detain, insisting that, quote, you can't detain and harass someone who doesn't exist in the republic. The Kremlin has denied any knowledge of a purge. Reports have emerged that men who have been arrested are being kept in horrific concentration camp-style prisons where violent abuse and torture is common. And so many are asking for the U.S. government to in some way intervene. It's just a horrific story. And this is what is still happening in the world. And we need to know that this is what's still happening in the world. And I know that there are issues here in the U.S. and there are things that we need to solve. And there are still things that we need to do, but this is what's happening in Russia and there in Chechnya. So write a letter to your editor, contact your congressperson, get in touch with someone. This is where we have to use our voices to stand up for other people so that more stories can be told. Our thanks, of course, to Dr. Robin Henderson Espinoza. They are doing such incredible work. I encourage you to check out their writing. And, of course, to Roger Dowdy. Give Out Day, giveoutday.org. That is coming up on April 20th. I urge you to support an organization. It will help them enormously, and you will feel great in the process. Until then, get out there. Go use your voice the way you know how to use it to make a difference for your LGBTQ brothers and sisters, for all of those allies out there. And while you're out there using your voice, while you're out there making a difference, please remember, why be gay when you can be so gay?